Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're here to take a whole stack of sources, pull out the really key insights, and basically give you that shortcut to being genuinely well-informed. Today, we are jumping into, well, the fascinating world of how businesses are actually put together, how they're structured. Our goal, cut through all that jargon and complexity. We want you to leave with a really clear picture of, say, what makes a sole trader tick versus a giant public company, or why an NGO isn't just another charity.
Exactly. And, you know, these business entities, they're not just fancy names. They really define how a business is owned, who's liable if things go wrong, and fundamentally how it operates day to day. Understanding these differences is honestly, it's crucial, whether you're looking at investments, trying to figure out market trends, or maybe even thinking about starting something yourself. So yeah, this deep dive should give you a real leg up in understanding that whole landscape of business and social impact too.
Okay. Let's kick off with a really big distinction, one that sort of underpins everything else: private versus public sectors.
Right.
At the most basic level, how do they operate differently and who's actually in charge?
Right. So the private sector, fundamentally, it's owned and controlled by private individuals or groups. And its main driver, well, it's typically profit maximization. It's market driven. The public sector, on the other hand, that's owned and controlled by the government. Its main purpose isn't profit, but providing essential goods and services for everyone. If you dig a bit deeper, you see the private sector usually needs to be quite flexible, competitive, you know. Survival often depends on being efficient and winning customers. The public sector, it's mainly funded by taxes. So it prioritizes things like accessibility, fairness, often operating in areas that private companies might not find profitable. Think national defense, maybe public transport infrastructure, certain healthcare aspects, making sure those vital services are there.
Got it. So for you listening, when you're dealing with any organization, knowing if it's private or public tells you a lot about its core mission and, crucially, where its money comes from. That's a key starting point. Good. With that base layer understood, let's dive into the structures that form, well, the bedrock of commerce.
Yeah.
Profit-based organizations. And let's start with probably the most straightforward one. The sole trader, that classic one-person show. We kind of get the idea, but what's the real pull for someone to go it alone? And maybe more importantly, what are those hidden risks people don't always see?
Yeah, the appeal is definitely the simplicity. It's incredibly easy to set up, very few legal hoops to jump through. You can get started fast, often just using personal savings or maybe a small loan. Plus, the owner keeps all the profit, has total control, can offer really personalized service. And your finances are private, you know, no public reporting. Decisions super quick. But, and this is the huge one, the hidden risk is unlimited liability.
All right. That's
yeah,
the one.
Absolutely. It means the owner and the business are legally the same thing. So the owner's personal stuff, their house, their car, their savings, it's all on the line if the business gets into debt or faces a lawsuit.
So it really begs the question, doesn't it? Is that super easy setup worth potentially losing your house?
Exactly. And the answer depends, right? For maybe a freelance writer or someone with a small, low-risk side project, that agility might be perfect. The risk seems remote. But imagine a tech startup needing big investment or planning to grow fast. That personal liability, it's a massive barrier. It limits growth, makes funding harder, and just exposes the founder way too much. The ease of setup becomes a real trap then.
That's a really important point. So, okay, solo is simple, but risky personally. What if you want to share the load, maybe bring in more money or skills? That leads us naturally to partnerships, I guess.
Precisely. A partnership is basically a business owned by two or more people. Usually they'll have what's called a deed of partnership.
Like a rule book?
Kind of, yeah. A vital document. It lays out how profits are split, who does what happens if someone leaves or, you know, worse. But here's the key thing on liability again. In a standard or general partnership, at least one partner, often all of them, still faces that same unlimited liability.
Okay, so the risk doesn't disappear entirely just by adding people?
Not necessarily.
But on the plus side, you do get more capital, right?
Yeah.
Pooling resources.
Definitely. More finance is a big advantage. And you share the workload, the stress, which can be huge. Plus, you can specialize. Maybe one person is great at sales, the other handles the tech side.
And you still keep things fairly private compared to big companies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's cheaper to set up than, say, forming a corporation.
Generally, yes. Financial privacy is better than for corporations, and setup costs are usually lower. But you still have that unlimited liability hanging over the general partners. And let's be honest, working closely with others means potential for disagreements, conflicts. Decision-making can slow right down because you need to consult everyone. And just like with sole traders, there's a continuity issue. If a partner dies or quits, legally, the partnership might dissolve, even if the underlying business is doing fine. It's that trade-off again. Shared burden, yes, but also shared and sometimes amplified risk.
Right. So we've seen unlimited liability as this major sticking point for sole traders and partnerships. What's the structure that really cracks that problem, allowing businesses to get huge and raise serious money without founders risking their personal homes? That must be where companies come in, the ones that are separate legal entities.
That's exactly it. The absolute game changer is right there in the name of the most common types. Limited liability.
Limited liability. Okay.
It means the owners, the shareholders, are only liable for the amount they've actually invested in the company. Their personal assets are protected if the company fails or gets sued. The business itself is incorporated. It becomes its own legal person, separate from the owners. It can own assets, sign contracts, borrow money, sue people, be sued, all in its own name.
That's a massive difference.
Huge. And there are two main flavors here we should touch on. First, the private limited company, often called LTD or PDLTD, shares are usually held by a smaller group, family, friends, initial investors. They aren't traded publicly, and transferring shares often needs agreement from other shareholders.
Okay, more tightly held.
Exactly. Then you have the public limited company, or PLC. These are the big ones, often listed on stock exchanges. Their shares can be bought and sold freely by the general public. This allows them to raise vast amounts of capital from potentially millions of investors.
And the advantages seem pretty obvious, especially for PLCs. Raising huge capital sums, that limited liability-making investment, way less scary.
Absolutely. Plus, continuity. Because the company is its own legal entity, it doesn't cease to exist if owners change or managers leave. It just keeps going.
And they can achieve economies of scale.
Right.
Getting more efficient as they get bigger.
Yes. Potential for economies of scale is significant. Producing more units usually means lower average costs, which helps competitiveness. And depending on the jurisdiction, there can sometimes be tax advantages compared to unincorporated structures.
But it can't all be upside. What are the downsides of incorporating, especially becoming a big PLC?
No, definitely not all upside. You're looking at way more compliance costs and bureaucracy. More rules, more regulations, more paperwork, more reporting. It's just more complex and expensive to run. There's also much less privacy. PLCs especially have to disclose a lot of financial information publicly.
So everyone knows your business.
Pretty much. And with larger companies, communication can become a real challenge, keeping everyone aligned. And particularly in PLCs, where ownership is spread super wide, the original founders or managers can actually lose control of the company they started if enough shares change hands.
So connecting that back, it's a major trade-off, isn't it? Access to serious capital and protection from personal risk, but in exchange for less privacy, more red tape, and potentially less direct control.
That sums it up perfectly. It's about choosing the structure that fits the scale and ambition and accepting the compromises that come with it.
Okay, that clarifies the journey from, you know, one person with an idea to potentially a global corporation. But what about businesses that deliberately try to mix profit with purpose? Businesses that want to make money and explicitly do good. That takes us into the territory of social enterprises.
Yes, for-profit social enterprises are a really interesting and growing category. They absolutely aim to generate revenue like any other business, but, and this is key, their core purpose includes achieving specific social or environmental objectives. So their main goals aren't just making a profit, but critically, reinvesting a good chunk of that profit or surplus back into their chosen social cause or community benefit. They also tend to operate very ethically, perhaps using frameworks like the triple bottom line, consciously measuring their impact on profit, people, and the planet.
So, practically, how does a private sector social enterprise actually operate differently day to day compared to a standard business just focused on profit?
Well, in their commercial activities, selling things, marketing, operations, they might look quite similar. They need to be efficient and commercially viable. The fundamental difference lies in what they do with the money they make. A traditional company's profit mostly benefits owners or shareholders. A social enterprise, however, channels a significant portion of that profit directly into achieving its social mission. They're not primarily relying on donations like a charity. Their business is the engine for their social impact.
Can you give an example, maybe?
Sure. Think of maybe a cafe that trains and employs homeless people using its profits to fund those programs, or perhaps an ecotourism company that reinvests its earnings into local conservation projects. The business activity itself drives the social outcome.
Okay, that makes sense for the private sector ones. But does the government ever get involved in this kind of model? Are there public sector social enterprises?
Yes, they exist too. You can think of them as state-owned enterprises, but specifically run with commercial principles to generate revenue for the government. That revenue then helps fund other essential public services. The idea is often to ensure efficiency in certain state operations while also contributing financially. Maybe a state-owned utility company that operates commercially, but its profits go back into the public budget rather than to private investors.
Interesting. Okay, another unique model, one that feels very community-focused, is the cooperative. What's the defining feature there? How do they stand apart?
Cooperatives or co-ops are really distinct because of their ownership structure. They are owned and run by their members. And crucially, those members are often the employees themselves or the customers or maybe suppliers, the people directly involved.
So not outside shareholders.
Exactly. And the core principle is usually democratic control. Typically, it's one member, one vote, regardless of how much capital someone put in or how long they've been there.
Wow, very different.
Very. And if the co-op makes a profit or surplus, it's usually shared among the members, maybe through dividends, lower prices, or reinvestment in member services rather than going to external investors. It creates this real sense of collective ownership and shared benefit.
You can imagine that builds incredible motivation and loyalty among the members.
Yeah.
What else are the big advantages?
Yeah, that strong motivation and sense of belonging are key. You often get really engaged members. Decision-making is democratic, which people value. There's usually a strong focus on social responsibility, ethical operations, and because they're often community-based, they can get significant public goodwill and support.
Sounds great, but are there downsides? What are the challenges for co-ops?
There are challenges. Access to finance can be tougher compared to corporations that can issue shares widely. Raising large amounts of capital can be difficult. That democratic decision-making, while fair, can sometimes be slow, especially if you need consensus from many members. And there's sometimes a potential disincentive effect. If profits have to be spread very thinly among a large membership, it might limit the drive for massive growth. This can also sometimes limit internal promotion opportunities compared to more hierarchical businesses.
So it raises that interesting tension, doesn't it? How do they balance that strong social mission and democratic structure with the practical need to grow, compete, and remain financially sustainable?
That's often the central challenge for cooperatives, yes. Balancing those elements effectively.
Okay, finally, let's look at organizations that are all about impact, with no profit motive at all. Non-governmental organizations or NGOs, what's their specific role in the ecosystem?
NGOs are fascinating. They operate in the private sector, meaning they're not government bodies, but they often provide services or tackle issues that might otherwise fall under public responsibility. Think humanitarian aid, education programs, environmental protection, healthcare initiatives, poverty reduction. They are fundamentally nonprofit. Their money comes mainly from donations, grants, maybe membership fees, volunteer work. They don't aim to make a profit for owners. Their critical role really is to step in and fill gaps where government action might be lacking or to advocate for specific causes, acting as vital agents of change or support systems.
And what defines them? What are their key features?
Well, first and foremost, the nonprofit objective. Any surplus cash they generate isn't distributed. It's plowed right back into achieving their social or environmental mission. Second, they are independent of direct government control. They might work with governments or receive funding from them sometimes, but they operate autonomously. And third, they typically have a really broad range of stakeholders, not just staff, but volunteers, donors, partner organizations, and crucially, the communities or individuals they aim to serve, the beneficiaries.
It really is amazing how much impact they can have, mobilizing huge resources, often volunteer effort, without that traditional profit driver.
It absolutely is. It shows the power of mission-driven organization.
Right. We have covered a huge amount of ground here. From the solo freelancer starting out all the way to massive global NGOs tackling huge problems. Let's try and crystallize this. What does all this mean for you, the listener, whether you're thinking about starting something, investing, or even just understanding the news better?
Okay, let's boil it down. Key takeaways. Private versus public sector. Remember, it's fundamentally about who owns it and why it exists, profit or public service.
Got it.
Liability. This is huge. Sole traders and general partners, usually unlimited personal risk. Companies, LTDs and PLCs, limited liability for shareholders. That massively changes the game for risk and investment.
Okay, liability is critical.
Continuity. Incorporated companies have a life of their own, legally separate from owners, much more stable long-term than sole traders or partnerships, which can dissolve if an owner leaves or dies.
Makes sense.
Access to finance. Generally much harder for sole traders and partnerships. Companies, especially PLCs, can potentially raise vastly more money.
Right. Funding follows structure.
And then those other models. Social enterprises are that unique mix doing business, but with a core social or ethical goal, reinvesting profits for impact. And NGOs operate entirely for community benefit, driven by mission, funded by donations, completely nonprofit.
So the structure you choose, or the structure an organization operates under, it really impacts everything: risk, funding potential, how decisions get made, and ultimately the kind of impact it can have economically or socially.
Exactly. It's all about aligning that structure with the underlying mission and the scale of ambition.
We've definitely journeyed through a complex landscape today, from, you know, the lone entrepreneur building something from scratch to these huge, globally operating NGOs. Hopefully this deep dive has given you a much clearer, maybe more nuanced view of the different ways businesses and organizations are structured all around us.
And maybe something to think about going forward. We live in a world with increasingly complex problems, right? Problems that maybe don't fit neatly into for-profit or nonprofit boxes. So how might we see more hybrid models emerge? Structures that deliberately blend elements of for-profit efficiency, social enterprise mission, and maybe even nonprofit collaboration. Could these hybrids be the future for tackling some of our biggest economic and societal challenges together?
That's a great thought to leave folks with. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Until next time, keep exploring.